nuclear physicists. The Alsos team whisked off Heisenberg, Hahn, von Laue, and several other German physicists to Farm Hall, an English manor house that had been converted into a military intelligence post. The house was supplied with sporting equipment, chalkboards, a radio, and plenty of food. More comforts than the average English family, grumbled one of their military minders. The average English family certainly didn't have Farm Hall's full complement of hidden microphones in each room. "I wonder whether there are microphones installed here," asked Kurt Dietner, one of the German physicists, several days after their arrival.
"Microphones installed?" replied Heisenberg, laughing. "Oh, no, they're not as cute as all that. I don't think they know the real Gestapo methods. They're a bit old-fashioned in that respect."
Reassured, the German physicists freely discussed physics, politics, and current events, eagerly reading the newspapers that their British minders had supplied in the express hope of provoking discussion. Heisenberg and the others also discussed the mystery of their continued detainment, inquiring, they were told only that they were being held at His Majesty's pleasure. Thinking themselves the world's foremost experts on nuclear physics, and convinced that any American bomb effort could not possibly have surpassed the German one, since German physics was superior, they hatched wild schemes to alert the press of their plight, to escape to Cambridge, and see their colleagues there who, they presumed, were desperate to consult them on their knowledge of nuclear matters. They even spoke matter-of-factly about their fates being decided personally by the Big Three, Truman, Churchill, and Stalin, who were meeting in Potsdam at the time. Some managed to convince themselves that their association with the Nazis would not be held against them personally, and that they would be able to use their status as elite physicists to escape to Argentina and start new lives. Finally, after weeks in luxurious captivity, the bubble burst. On the evening of August 6, 1945, just before dinner, Major Rittner, the British military intelligence officer in charge of Farm Hall, quietly took Otto Hahn aside and told him that the Americans had dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima. "Hahn was completely shattered by the news," wrote Rittner. "He felt personally responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, as it was his original discovery which had made the bomb possible. He told me that he had originally contemplated suicide when he realized the terrible potentialities of his discovery. With the help of considerable alcoholic stimulant, he was calmed down, and we went down to dinner, where he announced the news to the assembled guests. As was to be expected, the announcement was greeted with incredulity." "I didn't believe a word of the whole thing," said Heisenberg upon hearing the news. "I don't believe it has anything to do with uranium," Hahn jeered. "If the Americans have a uranium bomb, then you're all second-raters. Poor old Heisenberg."
After they heard the BBC report the news in great detail later that night, Heisenberg and the others accepted the truth. They had been beaten.
Over the next few days, Heisenberg attempted to work out how his project had fallen so far behind. His fumbling calculations show that he had never really understood how to even build a bomb in the first place, though he had certainly thought he'd understood it. And the bickering of the other scientists at Farm Hall confirmed what documents captured by Alsos had already suggested. The Nazi bomb program, unlike the Manhattan Project, was a disorganized mess, with vital information compartmentalized and no clear vision of how to proceed. Yet in those same few days, the Farm Hall transcripts make it clear that Heisenberg and his student, Carl von Weizsäcker, purposefully constructed a revisionist narrative of their wartime activities. According to them, while the Americans had built a weapon of death and destruction on unprecedented scales, they, the Germans, had deliberately pursued only a nuclear reactor, being unwilling to build a massive new weapon for Hitler's Reich, thereby placing the responsibility for their failure on their supposed moral clarity, rather than their sheer incompetence. While Heisenberg had been working to such honorable ends during the war, his mentor had been nearly killed. Bohr had returned to Copenhagen after his visit to America in 1939, arriving home several months before the outbreak of war that September. Germany invaded Denmark before sunrise on the morning of April 9th the following year. 2 hours later, the Danish government surrendered. Hitler was determined to make Denmark a model protectorate, demonstrating his peaceful ways to the rest of the world. He managed to curb his bloodlust and refrained from imposing anti-Semitic laws on the Danes for over 3 years. Finally, in October 1943, the SS arrived in the streets of Copenhagen. They planned to round up the city's Jews during Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, and one of the holiest days on the Jewish calendar. But when they went from door to door, they found that nearly all the Jews in the city had simply vanished. A German diplomat, Georg Duckwitz, had warned the leaders of Denmark's Jewish community days earlier, and most of the country's Jews had gone into hiding by the time the SS arrived. One of them was Niels Bohr, who had been ferried to safety in a fishing boat along with his family across the Öresund Strait and into neutral Sweden 3 days before the Nazis arrived to arrest him at his institute. In Stockholm, Bohr met with King Christian X and pled his case, asking the king to offer Danish Jews asylum in Sweden. Swedish radio announced the asylum offer that evening, and over the next 2 months, the Danish resistance and Swedish Coast Guard arranged passage for hundreds of small fishing boats, rowboats, and canoes, each boat ferrying 2, 3, 4 Jewish Danes to safety. More than 7,000 Jews, 95% of the Jews that lived in Denmark at the time, managed to evade the Nazis. Stockholm, crawling with Nazi agents, wasn't safe for Bohr, and the Allies decided that Bohr himself was too important to remain in Sweden anyhow. The British Royal Air Force dispatched a high-altitude Mosquito bomber, a small plane designed to fly higher than anti-aircraft fire, to bring Bohr to the UK. The small aircraft's bomb bay was specially equipped to carry Bohr, with an oxygen mask and a pair of headphones to allow the pilot to communicate with his precious cargo. But the headphones were too small for Bohr's enormous head. Unable to hear the command to turn on his oxygen, Bohr passed out. The pilot realized there was a problem and flew the plane low over the North Sea. Bohr survived. After a briefing in England, Bohr flew to the United States, where he was whisked to the headquarters of the Manhattan Project in Los Alamos, traveling under the alias Nicholas Baker. Guiding Nicholas around the facilities, Teller was looking forward to showing Bohr that his pessimism about nuclear power had been misguided. But before I could open my mouth, Bohr said, "You see, I told you it couldn't be done without turning the whole country into a factory. You have done just that." Bohr was more right than he knew. By the end of the war, the Manhattan Project had cost the nation nearly $25 billion, employing 125,000 people at 31 different locations across the United States and Canada. Hundreds of physicists were called away from their everyday laboratory work to satisfy Manhattan's relentless hunger for people and materials. After the war ended, physics research in the United States never returned to what it was before the war. Damned by their success in building the bomb, military research dollars poured into physics. In 1938, before the war, total spending on physics research in the United States was about $17 million, and nearly none of it came from the government. Less than a decade after the war, in 1953, physics research funding was just shy of $400 million, an increase by a factor of 25 in just 15 years. And by 1954, 98% of the money for basic research in the physical sciences in the United States was coming from the military or defense-oriented government agencies, like the Atomic Energy Commission, successor to the Manhattan Project. Along with that money came people. As the war ended under the shadows of two mushroom clouds, young veterans, funded by the GI Bill, flocked to universities to learn about the new physics. "My interest in physics," wrote a Harvard physics PhD student in 1948, "was aroused while I was working on the atomic bomb in New Mexico while in the Army." Another wrote that he had a feeling that the work, physics,
was important as a result of the war. Still another wrote that the war introduced me to the scientific life. Physics departments were inundated with students. In 1941, about 170 U.S. graduate students earned their PhDs in physics. By 1951, that number was over 500 and climbing, a far faster rate of growth than any other academic field over the same span of time. See Figure 4.1. And by 1953, half of all physics PhDs were under the age of 30. Educating physicists was no longer seen as a matter of mere scientific necessity, but an essential investment in military infrastructure. Henry Smith, Commissioner of the Atomic Energy Commission and former chair of the Princeton Physics Department, spoke of the stockpiling and rationing of scientific manpower in an address to the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences in 1950. Scientists, he said, have become a major war asset. It is important that they be used to the greatest advantage. I am speaking of scientists not as men who enrich our culture, but as tools of war needed for the preservation of our freedom. Plenty of physicists were alarmed and unhappy about this new state of affairs. The hot and cold wars have so changed my profession that I can hardly recognize it anymore, complained the Dutch-American physicist Samuel Goudschmidt. We physicists are among the maladjusted veterans of the Second World War. Goudschmidt, one of the handful of Jewish European physicists who immigrated to the United States well before Hitler came to power, pined for the string and sealing wax days before the war, when physics was done on a paltry budget with spare parts lying around. Less than a decade after the end of the war, the flood of people and money had radically altered the day-to-day work of physics. It's been a shock. We've got marvelous laboratories for basic research, which is the real love of any self-respecting physicist. But somehow we don't have the same tender affection for them that we would have had years ago, when acquiring a $300 spectroscope was reason enough for throwing a party. Today, we're given a multi-million-dollar piece of equipment, and the minute the dedication ceremonies are over, we're poring over plans for an even more powerful one. In the old days, physicists gave themselves up wholly to a single-minded study of the fundamental laws of the universe. Now we feel called upon to do things of a sort we'd never even imagined we'd be doing, thoroughly unscientific things. We sit down with the defense secretary to help him figure out his next year's budget. We brief the President of the United States on the nation's nuclear stockpile. Some of us are in industry, designing electronic equipment, and some of us are attached to the American embassy staffs in England, France, and Germany. Colleagues of mine who never even bothered to vote before Hiroshima now sit at the elbows of our United Nations representatives when the subject of atomic energy is on the agenda. Goudschmidt himself had his own taste of these unscientific activities during the war. He was the civilian leader of the Alsace mission, which had gathered up Heisenberg and other top German nuclear physicists and sent them to Farm Hall. He had also done work on radar at MIT, another major wartime physics research program employing thousands and costing millions, and consulted for the Royal Air Force. Before the war, he had worked at the University of Michigan and had planned to retire from research and devote himself to teaching full-time. After the war, he changed his mind. I felt caught up in the violent upsurge of everything associated with physics that had followed Hiroshima, Goudschmidt recalled, and I wanted to be more closely associated with it than seemed possible on a university campus. Goudschmidt became the head of the physics department at Brookhaven National Laboratory, one of the newly minted, government-run, pure research labs. Yet despite his administrative post in the new edifice of big science, Goudschmidt remained uneasy about the changes in his field. The conditions we work under today certainly aren't hastening a breakthrough, he said in 1953. A quarter of a century ago, we could exchange ideas in Bohr's study with no government secrets, weapons programs, or spy cases to bother us. None of us were distracted by offers to become college presidents or big wheels in industry, and governments didn't give a hoot about physics. There was no trying to elbow one's way to power for the simple reason that there wasn't any place to exercise power. No huge laboratories, no military projects. We all felt that we belonged to a sort of lodge with a worldwide membership of only 400 or so, and everyone knew everyone else well, or at least knew what everyone else was doing. Now 4 times that number will turn up for a meeting of just American physicists, and most of them will be strangers to each other. Research into the meaning of quantum physics was one of the casualties of the war. With all these new students crowding classrooms around the country, professors found it impossible to teach the philosophical questions at the foundations of quantum physics. Before the war, courses in quantum physics on both sides of the Atlantic, like Heisenberg's in Leipzig and Oppenheimer's in Berkeley, spent a great deal of time on conceptual issues. Textbooks and exams from the pre-war period asked students to write detailed essays on the nature of the uncertainty principle and the role of the observer in the quantum world. But with ballooning class sizes, detailed discussions of philosophy became all but impossible. With these subjects, such as uncertainty, complementarity, and causality, lecturing is of little avail, complained a physics professor at the University of Pittsburgh in 1956. The baffled student hardly knows what to write down, and what notes he does take are almost certain to horrify the instructor. Smaller quantum physics classes in smaller departments afforded foundational questions more time, about 5 times as much as larger classes. But as enrollments surged, few small physics classes were left. The larger classes focused on efficient, repeatable means of calculation rather than focusing on foundations. And textbooks nearly dropped questions about foundations altogether, as a new generation of reviewers in physics periodicals praised a new batch of texts for avoiding philosophical discussion and philosophically tainted questions. Textbooks that bucked the trend were condemned for spending too much time on the musty, atavistic to-do about position and momentum. The era of big science had arrived, and it had no patience for puzzling over the meaning of quantum physics. Heisenberg repeated his story about the German bomb program to anyone who would listen for the rest of his life. Goudschmidt, who had access to the Farm Hall reports and had seen the pathetic remnants of the Nazi nuclear program firsthand, knew Heisenberg's story was a fabrication. But with the existence of the Farm Hall transcripts itself classified, Goudschmidt could state only that Heisenberg was lying, without explaining how he knew. The first popular account of the Manhattan Project, Brighter Than a Thousand Suns, written by the Swiss journalist Robert Jungk in 1958, repeated Heisenberg's story almost verbatim. So did The Virus House, the first book dedicated solely to the history of the German bomb program, which relied heavily on interviews from Heisenberg and his fellow former Farm Hall detainees. The author, David Irving, was later revealed to be a Holocaust denier. Despite Heisenberg's public relations campaign, there was a cloud of suspicion over his head for the rest of his days. His relationship with Bohr, in particular, was never the same. After Jungk's book was published, Bohr drafted an angry letter to him over details of Heisenberg's account of a meeting they had in 1942. But in typical Bohr style, he drafted several versions of the letter and never sent it. Nonetheless, Bohr and Heisenberg did speak again, and even met several times after the war. Heisenberg's lies were, after all, rather minor compared to some. Pascual Jordan maintained that he had never truly supported the Nazi cause, despite his publications extolling the virtues of a National Socialist approach to science. He even had the audacity to send a letter to Max Born, his mentor who had been forced out by Hitler's racist policies, explaining that he hadn't really been a Nazi and asking for a character reference for his denazification. Born replied with a list of his friends and family members murdered by the Nazis. Given the damage done to his reputation by his activities during the war, Heisenberg's invention of a single, unified Copenhagen interpretation may have been an attempt to rework the history of quantum physics to his benefit. The Copenhagen interpretation wasn't a pure fabrication. There were certainly similarities in the positions that Bohr and his students and colleagues took. But the differences between Heisenberg's lecture and the writings of Bohr himself should have been enough to tip off anyone who was paying attention that no such beast had ever really existed. Yet the idea of a single, settled interpretation of quantum physics associated with the giants Bohr and Heisenberg went over well in the post-Manhattan world of big science. Most physicists were perfectly happy with the jumble of ideas that purportedly constituted the Copenhagen interpretation itself, since questions about the meaning of quantum physics had little bearing on their work. The mathematical formalism of the theory continued to work remarkably well in a wide variety of post-war applications of physics to the military-industrial complex, which turned most physicists to work in nuclear physics or solid-state physics, the branch of physics that, shortly after the war, led to the development of the silicon transistor, as well as many of the other materials later responsible for the shrinking size and ballooning importance of computers. Questions of interpretation, while vital for the progress of science in the long term, were immaterial when it came to the hard-nosed applications of quantum theory that were so suddenly and desperately prized. The Copenhagen interpretation's promise of a complete yet obscure answer to the quantum mysteries allowed the new army of post-war physicists to calculate answers without worrying about the meaning of the theory. The shift of physicists to the United States aided in this as well. In contrast to the great theorists of Europe, physicists in the States had always had an experimental and pragmatic bent. The questions at the foundations of quantum physics that had seemed so vital to Einstein and Bohr were dismissed by the new crop of American physicists as dreamy trifles, hardly suitable as subjects of inquiry to be funded by the rivers of money flowing from the Pentagon. But not all American physicists were pragmatic enough to swallow the Copenhagen interpretation. Bohr's principle, complementarity, puts nature on the fence and leaves it there, grumbled Henry Margonow, a philosophically minded physicist working at Yale. It relieves its advocates of the need to bridge a chasm in understanding by declaring that chasm to be unbridgeable and perennial. It legislates a difficulty into a norm. One American physicist in particular was destined to cause serious trouble for the Copenhagen interpretation. He had worked with Oppenheimer at Berkeley during the war and was recruited by Princeton shortly thereafter. In 1947, David Bohm arrived at Princeton, a freshly minted assistant professor. He had accepted the Copenhagen interpretation in his career to date, but soon he would be irritated by pesky doubts. Within 5 years, those doubts ballooned into a full-scale personal rebellion against the quantum orthodoxy. David Bohm was about to do the impossible, defy von Neumann's proof, shock John Bell out of the uneasy peace he had made with Copenhagen, and change quantum physics forever. Part 2. Quantum dissidents. We emphasize not only that our view is that of a minority, but also that current interest in such questions is small. The typical physicist feels that they have long been answered, and that he will fully understand just how, if ever he can spare 20 minutes to think about it. John Bell and Michael Naumburg, 1966. 5. Physics in Exile. Max Dresden entered the crowded seminar room, all eyes on him as he took his place alone in front of the chalkboard. Dresden was a physicist at the University of Kansas, and during his visit to Princeton's Institute for Advanced Study in 1952, he had volunteered to give a talk on the fascinating new work by David Bohm. Dresden was eager to hear what his audience thought of Bohm's work. The Princetitute was home to some of the finest minds in all of physics, including Einstein himself, though, as Dresden looked out at the room, Einstein's unruly white hair was nowhere to be seen. Dresden students had brought Bohm's paper to his attention, and he had initially dismissed their questions by citing von Neumann's famous proof that the Copenhagen interpretation was the only way of understanding quantum physics. But, after repeated pestering, Dresden finally looked at Bohm's paper, and he was surprised by what he found. Bohm had discovered a totally new way to interpret quantum physics. Rather than refusing to answer questions about the quantum world, as the Copenhagen interpretation did, Bohm's interpretation depicted a world of subatomic particles that existed whether or not anyone was looking at them. Particles with definite positions at all times. These particles, in turn, each had pilot waves that determined their motion, which also behaved in an orderly and predictable fashion. Somehow, Bohm had found a way to tame the chaotic and unknowable world of the quantum, and he had done it without sacrificing accuracy, because Bohm's theory was mathematically equivalent to normal quantum physics. Over the course of his talk, Dresden presented Bohm's ideas and mathematics to his audience. When he finished, the moment he dreaded arrived. The floor was opened to questions from the room of luminaries. Dresden had offered to give this talk on less than a week's notice, and desperately hoped that he was prepared for what was sure to be a high-level technical discussion of someone else's ideas. Instead, to Dresden's horror, the room erupted in vitriol. One person called Bohm a public nuisance, another called him a traitor, still another said he was a Trotskyite. As for Bohm's ideas, they were dismissed as mere juvenile deviationism, and several people implied that Dresden himself was at fault as a physicist to have taken Bohm seriously. Finally, Robert Oppenheimer, the director of the Institute, spoke up. Oppenheimer was one of the most influential and famous physicists alive. He had led the Manhattan Project to success during the war, and he had mentored a blazingly brilliant team of physicists at Berkeley before that, including Bohm himself. Dresden watched in shock as Oppenheimer suggested to the room that, if we cannot disprove Bohm, then we must agree to ignore him. Bohm wasn't there to defend his own ideas. He had been on the Princeton University faculty just a few months earlier, but now he was trapped in Brazil, exiled and blacklisted from his native country, while his former colleagues dismissed his new theory out of hand. This story, Dresden's discovery of Bohm's paper, his visit to Princeton, the astonishingly obtuse responses of the physicists there, might be accurate. It's certainly one of the stories that people tell about Bohm and the reception of his ideas. Oppenheimer's supposed quote about ignoring Bohm has become particularly notorious. But there are a lot of stories that people tell about Bohm, many of which are poorly sourced or lacking sources entirely. These stories exist because, a quarter century after his death, David Bohm remains an intensely polarizing figure. He is written off as a kook, a deluded mystic, a hopelessly conservative throwback who wanted to return to the physics of Isaac Newton. He is also hailed as a visionary, the patron saint of heretics in the one true church of Copenhagen. One of the problems with writing about David Bohm is that he really was persecuted and was forced to flee across the globe at some of the most crucial points in his life, which means that many of his most interesting personal papers were lost or destroyed. Furthermore, the people who disagreed with Bohm are the people who won, and, being victors, they went about doing what victors do with history, which makes it even more difficult to separate myth from fact. And to make things even worse, there's pushback from Bohm's defenders that takes things too far, overcompensating for the revisionist history of the Orthodox camp. There's a biography of Bohm, written by his friend and colleague David Peet. He paints Bohm as a sort of secular saint with improbably clear vision about the nature of reality. Moreover, the biography is riddled with factual errors and also takes some quotes out of context and produces others with no clear evidence that they were ever said. Finally, interest in Bohm's work increased markedly shortly after he died and shows no signs of stopping, leading to a slew of new questions that would have been easy to answer had anyone bothered to ask them of Bohm before he died in 1992. This convoluted situation has produced a remarkable number of myths and legends about a relatively obscure physicist who died well within living memory. Those legends are important. They tell us something about the role Bohm plays in the culture of quantum physics. They also tell us about the reactions that Bohm's ideas provoked. Behind those legends is a remarkably simple theory about how the quantum world works and the remarkably complex life of a single, unfortunate, and brilliant man. We know for a fact that David Joseph Bohm was born on December 20, 1917, in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Bohm's father, Samuel, was a Jewish immigrant from Hungary who came to Pennsylvania alone at the age of 19. There he met and married Frieda Popke, a Lithuanian Jew who had come over to the United States with her family years earlier. Samuel Bohm was a down-to-earth man who owned a furniture store in town, and he was known to the locals as a wheeler dealer and a skirt chaser. Frieda Bohm, in contrast, was a shy homemaker. She had been quiet and withdrawn ever since her family left Europe, who went through violent mood swings. Her erratic behavior worsened as Bohm grew older. She heard voices, broke a neighbor's nose, and threatened to kill her husband, ultimately ending up in a psychiatric institution. Though David was close with his mother, her frightening behavior forced him to seek refuge in books. Upon discovering science fiction, Bohm was hooked, and his interests steered toward science. Bohm's father had little patience for the scientism of his son. When David informed him of the existence of other planets orbiting the sun, Samuel merely dismissed the fact as irrelevant to the world of human affairs. But he nonetheless paid for Bohm's college education, sending him to Penn State, which was a small rural college at the time, not the enormous state university it is today. At Penn State, Bohm's brilliance was obvious to his friends and professors alike, as were his personal quirks. Bohm had a talent for getting people to want to take care of him, according to his friend Melba Phillips, and a talent for being unhappy. Bohm was continually concerned with his health, and suffered from terrible stomach aches from his Penn State days onward. Despite all this, he worked hard and won a spot in the physics PhD program at Caltech upon his graduation from Penn State in 1939. The Pennsylvania immigrant's son had made good. He was at one of the leading centers for physics in the world. But after one semester at Caltech, he became dissatisfied with the coursework and research options available. Bohm thought the research being done at Caltech was incremental rather than fundamental, and he found the environment too competitive for his liking. "I wasn't really happy there at Caltech," he recalled later. "They're not interested in science. They were more interested in competition and getting ahead and mastering techniques and so on." Discouraged and uncertain about his future, he went home to Wilkes-Barre for a summer. When he returned to Pasadena in the fall, he became even more unhappy. "In general, I was getting a little bit, not exactly depressed, but probably a little low." At a friend's suggestion, Bohm approached a charismatic young visiting professor to ask whether there were any open spots in his research group at Berkeley. By the start of the next semester, Bohm had moved up the California coast to work with his new mentor, J. Robert Oppenheimer. In Oppenheimer, Bohm found a kindred spirit, a Jew from the East Coast who wanted to tackle the largest outstanding problems in theoretical physics, and who was also interested in a wide range of intellectual pursuits beyond physics. But there were also profound differences between Bohm and Oppenheimer. Most notably, while Bohm's family was solidly working class, Oppenheimer came from a wealthy, well-connected family in the Manhattan social scene. Despite the anti-Semitic Jewish quotas that existed at the time, Oppenheimer had managed to go to Harvard for his undergraduate degree. After graduating summa cum laude in 3 years, he went off to Europe and earned his Ph.D. under Max Born. Later, Oppenheimer spent time working with Pauli in Switzerland, and though he never studied in Copenhagen, Oppenheimer met Bohr and came to know him quite well. When Oppenheimer, or Oppie as he was known to his friends and students, came back to the United States, he set to work turning Berkeley into the first great department of theoretical physics in the country. By the time Bohm showed up in 1941, physicists in Berkeley knew that Bohr was God and Oppie was his prophet, as Joe Weinberg, one of Oppie's other graduate students, put it. When Bohm arrived, Weinberg set about converting the new student. "With Weinberg, I had intense discussions of Bohr on complementarity," Bohm recalled later. "At that time, I was convinced that Bohr's approach was the right approach, and for many years I continued with Bohr's approach. I was carried away with it because Weinberg was a very intense, convincing person, and since Oppenheimer was also behind it, that gave it a lot of weight in my mind." Quantum physics wasn't the only thing that occupied Bohm's mind in Berkeley. He was also keeping an eye on the war raging in Europe, and what he saw there made communism look good. "Until, say, in 1940 or 41, I wouldn't have had much sympathy with the Communist Party," Bohm recalled later. "The thing that deeply impressed me was the collapse of Europe in the face of the Nazis, which I felt was due to the lack of will to resist. I thought the Nazis were a total threat to civilization. It seemed that the Russians were the only ones who were really fighting them. That was the main thing. Then I began to listen to what they said more sympathetically." Bohm joined the Berkeley campus chapter of the Communist Party in November 1942. But he found the reality of the party less appealing than the idea. "I began to feel that they did nothing but talk about things of no significance, about trying to organize protests of affairs on the campus and so on. The meetings were interminable." Bohm left the party after several months, but he remained a Marxist in his political convictions for many years afterward. Bohm's politics presented a problem for him when it came time to defend his PhD. Despite the fact that Oppenheimer had personally requested that Bohm be transferred to Los Alamos, Bohm had been denied security clearance by the Army. Army security lied to Oppenheimer, telling him that Bohm was a security risk because he still had relatives in Europe that could be used against him. In reality, Bohm had been denied clearance because of his association with Weinberg, who was also a member of the Communist Party. But Bohm's thesis research on interactions between atomic nuclei was nonetheless very relevant for the work going on at Los Alamos. So much so that it was immediately classified beyond Bohm's clearance. His notes and calculations were seized by the Army, and he was forbidden from writing his own thesis. Oppenheimer swooped into the rescue, assuring the UC Berkeley administration that Bohm deserved his PhD. Bohm continued on at Berkeley for a couple of years after the war, publishing papers on various recondite areas of quantum physics. In 1947, on the basis of that work and a favorable interview report from John Wheeler, Princeton's physics department hired Bohm as an assistant professor. "Bohm has been recommended to us as one of the ablest young theoretical physicists that Oppenheimer has turned out," wrote Henry Smith, the chair of the department. Several years later, Smith would write of stockpiling scientific manpower. Bohm found Princeton's campus and climate a disappointing change after his time in Berkeley, and he thought the faculty there were very status-conscious. But Bohm quickly settled in. He started teaching quantum physics classes using Oppenheimer's old notes and began research collaborations with several promising graduate students. He formed a small group of close friends and even struck up a relationship with Hannah Lowy, the stepdaughter of a professor at the Institute of Advanced Study. Bohm's relationship with Lowy soon turned serious, and there was talk of marriage. Lowy brought Bohm home to meet her mother, Alice, and her stepfather, Eric Kahle. Bohm also met one of Kahle's closest friends, Albert Einstein. On Wednesday, May 25th, 1949, David Bohm appeared before the House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, sitting opposite six congressmen, including one Representative Richard M. Nixon and another half-dozen congressional staffers. Bohm was asked about the extent of his association with the Communist Party.
"I can't answer that question," he replied.
because it might tend to incriminate and degrade me, and also I think it infringes on my rights as guaranteed by the First Amendment.
The committee asked him to repeat himself, then asked him dozens more questions, asking Bohm to implicate several of his former colleagues and friends from his time at Berkeley, including Joe Weinberg. Bohm refused. Then he went home and didn't think much more about it for over a year.
Apparently the whole issue was dying away, he recalled later.
Bohm had other troubles on his mind. He was assembling his quantum physics course materials into a textbook, taking great care to explain and defend the Copenhagen interpretation. But doubts had crept in, and as the book neared completion in the summer of 1950, those doubts grew.
When I finished the book, I wasn't quite satisfied that I really understood it, Bohm said.
Then, on December 4, 1950, a U.S. Marshal walked into Bohm's office and arrested him. Bohm was taken down to a federal courthouse in Trenton and indicted for contempt of Congress for refusing to testify to HUAC. Loewy, along with Bohm's student Sam Schwieber, drove to Trenton and bailed Bohm out. When they returned to Princeton, they found that Harold Dodds, the president of the university, had already suspended Bohm from research and teaching duties and forbidden him to set foot on campus. Bohm was blacklisted. In February 1951, while he waited for his day in court, Bohm had a small party to celebrate the publication of his new textbook, Quantum Theory. Bohm's book laid out quantum physics in a simple and straightforward way, with an emphasis on concepts rather than equations. It devoted an entire section to the measurement problem, in which Bohm diligently defended the Copenhagen interpretation.
I wrote this book, which I had hoped to be from Bohr's view, he recalled later. I tried to understand it as best I could. I taught the thing, quantum physics, for 3 years, and put out notes and then finally a book.
Bohm's book was released to generally favorable reviews. Bohm even received a very enthusiastic response to his book from the notoriously harsh Wolfgang Pauli, who said he'd enjoyed Bohm's approach to the subject. Shortly after his book came out, Bohm received a phone call that changed the course of his life.
Einstein telephoned, Bohm said. I was staying at a house with some friends of his, and he wanted to see me.
Einstein had read Bohm's book and wanted to talk with him about it.
I went to see him and we discussed the book, Bohm recalled. He, Einstein, thought that I had done as well as you could for explaining this theory, but he still was not satisfied that it was adequate. Basically, his objections were that the theory was conceptually incomplete, that this wave function was not a complete description of the reality, and there was more to it than that. That was his basic objection.
Einstein was harping on the same problem he had identified 25 years earlier. Quantum physics, for all its successes, was stubbornly mute on the question of what was real.
We discussed it, and he felt that one needs a theory in which one could discuss some reality which was existing and would stand by itself, and did not always have to be referred to an observer, Bohm recalled. He really felt quite definite that the quantum theory was not doing this. Therefore, though he accepted that it was giving the right results, he felt that it was incomplete.
Bohm walked out of Einstein's office with one thought ringing in his head. Can I make another way of looking at it? Was there another way to interpret the strange mathematics of quantum physics, or was the Copenhagen interpretation the only way to think about the theory?
It seemed that Einstein was right, and I already felt dissatisfied, Bohm recalled. I began to wonder, does the wave function give a complete description of reality?
Einstein was sure that it didn't. Bohm took that idea and ran with it. In a matter of weeks, he discovered there was a simple way to rewrite the fundamental equations of quantum theory. The predictions and results remained the same. The new version was mathematically equivalent to the old. But the picture of the world suggested by the math, the story it told, was radically different from the Copenhagen interpretation. Bohm was amazed at what he had found. He wrote up his ideas and sent them off in a pair of papers to be published in Physical Review, the most prominent research journal in physics. In the meantime, Bohm had more good news. On May 31st, he appeared in federal district court in Washington, D.C., where he was cleared of all charges. But the next month, under tremendous pressure from President Dodds, the Princeton Physics Department announced that they would not be renewing Bohm's contract, leaving him out of a job. Einstein wrote several letters of recommendation for Bohm, but to no avail. Despite his legal innocence, Bohm remained on the blacklist. Toward the end of that summer, Bohm, with help from Einstein and Oppenheimer, found a job at the University of Sao Paulo in Brazil. Bohm had never been outside the United States, and he didn't speak a word of Portuguese. But he had no other options. And he also suspected that he was under FBI surveillance. He left for Brazil in October. Throughout his ordeal, Bohm remained hopeful that when his papers appeared in print the upcoming January, his new view of quantum theory would inspire debate and gain him recognition among his fellow physicists. "It is hard to predict the reception of my article," he wrote to a friend back in Princeton, not long after arriving in Brazil. "But I am happy that in the long run it will have a big effect." What he really feared, he continued, was that the big shots will treat my article with a conspiracy of silence, perhaps implying privately to the smaller shots that while there is nothing demonstrably illogical about the article, it really is just a philosophical point of no practical interest. Bohm attempted to learn Portuguese, adjusted to yet another new and to him unpleasant climate, and waited for his ideas to finally meet the world. In Bohm's interpretation of quantum physics, much of the mystery of the quantum world simply falls away. Objects have definite positions at all times, whether or not anyone is looking at them. Particles have a wave nature, but there is nothing complementary about it. Particles are just particles, and their motions are guided by pilot waves. Particles surf along these waves, guided by the wave's motion, hence the name. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle still holds. The more we know about a particle's position, the less we know about its momentum, and vice versa. But according to Bohm, this is simply a limitation on the information that the quantum world is willing to yield to us. We may not know where a given electron is, but in Bohm's universe, it's always somewhere. This simple idea allowed Bohm to cut through the thicket of quantum paradoxes. The Copenhagen interpretation doesn't let you ask what's happening to Schrödinger's cat before you look in the box, insisting only that it's meaningless to talk about the unobservable. But in Bohm's pilot wave interpretation, not only can you ask, but there's an answer. Before you look in the box, the cat is either dead or alive, and opening the box merely reveals which is true. The act of observation has nothing to do with the condition of the cat. At first blush, this seems far too easy. If, in Bohm's theory, there is nothing strange about particle positions or Schrödinger's cat, how can it possibly hope to reproduce all the bizarre results of quantum physics? But the guarantee is in the mathematics. Bohm's theory is mathematically equivalent to the Schrödinger equation, the central equation of quantum physics, and therefore it must make the same predictions as any other interpretation. This is technically true, but it doesn't give a feel for how Bohm's interpretation actually works. To do that, we'll need to look at one of the strangest experiments in all of quantum physics, the double slit. The great physicist Richard Feynman famously said that the double slit experiment has in it the heart of quantum mechanics, and that in reality, it contains the only mystery. Yet for all that hype, it's a surprisingly simple experiment. Set up a screen in front of a photographic plate and place two narrow, closely spaced slits in the screen. Then shine a light on it. The light waves will interfere with each other on the other side of the slits, creating a pattern of light and dark bands on the photographic plate. See figure 5.2. There's nothing particularly quantum about this. Waves create interference patterns all the time, whether they're overlapping waves from two stones thrown in a pond or sound waves coming from two stereo speakers. wave interference isn't mysterious. In spots where the peaks of one wave line up with the valleys of another, they cancel out, and the waves vanish. When the peaks of both waves line up with each other, they're amplified. This creates the patterns of dark and light bands in Figure 5.2. The weirdness really begins when you shine a much dimmer light on the double slit. Rather than shining a flashlight on the double slit, send the minimum amount of light possible, one photon at a time. Now, each photon faces a choice. Like our nanometer Hamlet from the introduction, go through the left slit or the right slit. Once a photon goes through a slit, it hits the photographic plate behind the slit, leaving a dot on impact. Repeat this over and over again, and you might expect to see two groups of dots, one lined up behind each slit. See Figure 5.3a. After all, photons are particles, little tennis balls of light. If you threw tennis balls through a much larger double slit, you'd expect them to mostly hit the back wall in two clusters, one behind each slit. But photons aren't really tennis balls of light, and they do something extraordinary instead. Though each one hits the plate in a single location, their impacts collectively form an interference pattern on the plate. See Figure 5.3b. Even though each photon went through the double slit individually, they still somehow knew where to arrive on the photographic plate in order to form an interference pattern. Something was interfering with each photon as it went through, despite the fact that particles don't interfere with each other, and there was only one particle in the double slit at a time anyhow. Puzzled by the results of your experiment, you repeat it, but with a twist. This time, you attach a little photon detector to each slit in an attempt to determine which slit each photon goes through, so you can figure out how the interference pattern on the plate is formed. The results convince you of what you had already suspected, but hadn't dared to believe. The photons are deliberately messing with you. Now that you're watching them so closely, they refuse to form an interference pattern at all, and instead form exactly the two groups of dots that you had expected before. See Figure 5.3a. What gives? How can the photons behave differently just because you're watching them? How do they know you're watching them at all? The Copenhagen interpretation, true to form, gives a mystical pseudo-answer steeped in the language of Bohr's philosophy of complementarity. The idea of particles, Copenhagen claims, is complementary to the idea of waves. The ideas are contradictory. Photons cannot be both particles and waves, but both are necessary in alternation for describing this experiment. When you aren't measuring the position of a photon, it is a wave. Thus, photons can interfere with themselves as they pass through the double slit. But measuring the location of a photon forces it to behave as a particle. When the photon hits the screen behind the double slit, it must strike in only one spot. Similarly, putting photon detectors on each slit causes the photon to behave as a particle as it passes through the double slit. The detectors force each photon to pass through only one slit, and thus not interfere with themselves, when before they were free to behave as waves and pass through both slits. But asking where the photon was before the measurement is meaningless. Waves have no singular location. The property measured was created by the measurement itself, and to ask about its location beforehand is mere sophistry. Any attempt to picture how this is possible, any attempt to give an account of how the quantum world behaves between measurements, is doomed to fail because, as Bohr said, there is no quantum world. Bohm accounted for the strange results of the double-slit experiment by doing exactly what the Copenhagen interpretation said was impossible. He gave a detailed account of what happens in the quantum world whether or not anyone is looking. Photons, according to Bohm, are particles surfing on waves. While a particle can only pass through one slit, its pilot wave passes through both and interferes with itself. That self-interference, in turn, affects the motion of the particle because it is guided by the wave. The wave pushes the particle onto a path, ensuring the appearance of an interference pattern on the photographic plate, after enough photons have been sent through the double slit. See figure 5.4. Putting photon detectors on each slit affects each photon's pilot wave. No matter how ingenious the design, any photon detector must alter a photon's pilot wave, as ensured by Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which, in Bohm's interpretation, places limits on how much measuring devices can avoid interfering with the things they attempt to measure. The effect of these measurements on the photon's pilot waves alters their trajectories, causing them to form a pair of clusters on the photographic plate, rather than an interference pattern. In Bohm's account, although measurement can influence a particle's motion, all particles have definite positions whether or not anyone is looking at them. Bohm's interpretation is a lot like de Broglie's old interpretation, presented at the 1927 Solvay conference. The mathematics of the two interpretations are essentially identical, differing only in their emphasis of certain ideas over others. And the key physical insight is the same: a quantum world composed of particles guided by waves. But Bohm succeeded where de Broglie failed. Bohm handily solved the problems raised by Pauli, Cramers, and others a quarter century earlier at Solvay by insisting that everything be treated in a quantum way, both the things being measured and the devices doing the measuring. This was a truly radical idea, taking quantum physics seriously as a way of accounting for the entire world. In Bohm's pilot wave interpretation, strange quantum behaviors are minimized for larger objects, which is why we don't see them in the everyday world. But every object, big and small, is ultimately governed by the same set of quantum equations. The Copenhagen interpretation, in contrast, did not see quantum physics as a way to account for the whole world, and especially not experimental equipment involved in making measurements, like photographic plates or double slits. According to Bohr, one of the fundamental features of quantum physics was the necessity of accounting for the functions of the measuring instruments in purely classical terms, excluding in principle any regard to the quantum. Quantum mechanics was a physics of the small, not of the large, and never the twain shall meet. When Bohr's student, George Gamow, wrote about a fantasy world in which quantum effects appeared at large scales, purely as a way of explaining to non-scientists how quantum physics worked, Bohr was irritated rather than amused. Quantum physics, according to Copenhagen, was not to be taken seriously as a theory of the entire world. It was instead a theory about how we interfaced with the world of the extremely tiny. A pragmatic invention, a means for predicting the outcomes of experiments, and nothing more. And this was as it should be, according to Bohr. He claimed that the job of physicists was not to disclose the real essence of the world around us, but simply to find methods for ordering and surveying human experience. Is Bohr right? Is it wrong to say that physicists should attempt to figure out how the world actually is? Is it enough to come up with theories that make accurate predictions about the outcomes of experiments? And if Bohm's theory gives the same predictions as regular quantum physics, whatever that is, then what's the point of it? How can there be any important difference between two competing theories that make the same predictions? These questions point to difficult issues in the philosophy of silence, some of which we'll meet again in Chapter 8. The short answer is that no, Bohr is not correct, at least not straightforwardly. The picture of the world that comes along with a physical theory is an important component of that theory. Two theories that are identical in their predictions can have wildly different pictures of the world, like putting the Earth at the center of the universe rather than the sun. And those pictures, in turn, determine a lot about the daily practice of science. If you think that the sun is at the center of the solar system rather than the Earth, you're likely to conclude that
there's nothing special about Earth or our solar system, and that there could easily be planets around other stars, even though both astronomical theories give the same predictions about how different lights will move across the sky here on Earth.